and mythological tales, carrying their culture to younger generations. On a nice night, warm and mammoth-gorged, they could feel a real sense of security and well-being and envision a beckoning future. Suddenly, in the dark, a loud and unexplained mammalian noise sliced through their sense of security. Instantly and instinctually, they all looked toward the source of that noise. In the bushes, and prepared for what could be threatening and ugly. An attacking rival tribe, perhaps, or a lion, or a stampeding wildebeest herd. Every ear and eye correctly focused on the noise to maximize the human power to identify and, if possible, overcome the threat. If you were from another tribe and led a warring group wanting to attack this camp, what would you do? To be clever, you might throw a stone or create some other ruckus that distracts the camp, then attack from a different direction. Of course, a stampeding herd wouldn't do that. But for the camp, in case of a planned attack from clever marauders, a more evolved military-like response would be to have some folks look away from the noise, into the darkness, elsewhere, to spot any surprise marauder threat. The problem? Unless well-organized, no group of people behaves that way. You hear a noise in the darkness, and you turn toward it. Go camping sometime and see. Your instinctual reaction isn't to turn away from the noise, but toward it. In Stone Age days, that instinct protected lives from the most common natural forces. From tens of thousands of years of evolution, we are mentally hardwired to turn toward the noise, face it as a group, and instinctually presume our ability to immediately unite our tribal eyes and ears and react. I suspect some listeners may be tempted to say, "Not me, I'm smarter than that. I'd look in the other direction, I wouldn't be fooled." The next time you hear an unexpected noise, check what your instinctual reaction is. I near guarantee you'll look to the noise. If you don't, you're really, really weird. The person who thinks he won't is most certainly the person turning to the noise fastest. The rare bird that doesn't face the noise doesn't think about it. To know what your fellow investors don't know, you must look anywhere but where everyone else is looking. You must train yourself to stop looking toward the noise. Instead, note whenever everyone is looking one direction, whether you hear a noise or not, you should look away, where they're not. Discounting the media machine and advanced fad avoidance. You may be tempted to ignore the media altogether, since what you hear or read is likely wrong or already discounted into current prices. There is some rationality to that view, but it's wrong. By all means, don't avoid mass media. It's your friend and ally on your quest to invest by knowing what others don't. The media is a discounting machine. You must read, watch, listen to the media to know what everyone else is focused on, so you know exactly what you can ignore and look away from to focus elsewhere. Whatever they're fretting, you likely needn't, because they're doing it for you, a service, and you don't even have to pay them for it. Such a simple concept is very hard for tribal-oriented humans to get, but anyone can train themselves to do it. For example, I've already told you the collective histrionics regarding the so-called budget and trade deficits are typically misguided. You may not believe it, but I've told you. You also know pretty much everyone misinterprets high PEs. We debunk more ubiquitous myths in later chapters, but you get the idea. Paying attention to what the media covers and consequently discarding what is irrelevant will prevent you from being trampled by herd mentality and let you begin fathoming new paths. Avoiding being trampled by the herd sounds easy enough. Look where they are stampeding and get the heck out of the way. However, if it were easy, it wouldn't be called herd mentality. It would be called calm, non-compelling, no pressure here. Join us as we run over this cliff, if you please. If not, no problem mentality. Remember when your mom asked if you'd jump off a bridge just because cool kid Jimmy did it? Of course you wouldn't jump, but you might buy small-cap stocks at the wrong time if your poker group pokes enough fun at you for not having done it when they did. My March 1995 Forbes column, Advanced Fad Avoidance, described how best to avoid getting swept away with the herd. It's still good advice, so I'll repeat the four steps to fad avoidance here. 1. If most folks you know agree with you on a price move or some event's impact, don't take this as confirmation you are right. It is a warning. You are wrong. Being right requires aloneness and willingness to let others see you as maybe nuts. Still very true. And lots of people think I'm nuts. It's okay if people think you're nuts. It doesn't hurt. With the evolution of the internet and blogs, I've become used to people reading my articles and columns and writing scathing criticisms of me. Of course, sometimes they're right, and that would be when I'm wrong, but either way, what they think of me isn't any of my business. I've trained myself to ignore what anyone who I don't already know very well thinks about me or my work. If my wife is upset at me, I take it seriously. She knows me and my strengths and weaknesses and desires my well-being. Family, friends, associates. Other than that, if you're upset at me and don't like something I've said, feel free to criticize, but know you will run into an emotional desert. You can train yourself to have that same emotional desert too. What most people think about you is none of your business, and if they think you're nuts, it might be good. 2. If you read or hear about some investment idea or significant event more than once in the media, it won't work. By the time several commentators have thought and written about it, even new news is too old. Even more true today, the internet has multiplied the venues and speed at which news travels. Now everything moves faster and gets discounted into pricing faster, compounding the discounting speed, which has been increasing for decades. Traders trade 24 hours a day, fully 5.5 days a week around the globe. It used to be evening news didn't sneak up on you until morning. Now, not only does news move across the internet at night, but someone, somewhere, is trading extensively while you snooze. 3. The older an argument is, the less power it has. So, for example, inflation fears may have moved markets in 1994. But sometime early in 1995, that view will run out of steam. Every year's hot fear is likely obsolete the next year. It's the new thing no one expected that has the herd stampeding around your village, not last year's noise. To think better about this, take any issue and consider when you first heard about it. The older it is, the more certain it won't affect you much. The more certain everyone has had multiple opportunities to discount the price fully. Here is the best example I can remember. Recall people expected all computers to break down on January 1, 2000, because of a supposed widespread glitch in everyone's software. The Y2K scare was ubiquitous, and in the fall of 1999, it scared lots of folks out of stocks. I devoted my October 18, 1999 Forbes column entitled Greater Fools to why Y2K wouldn't hurt stocks. I said then, Y2K is the most widely hyped disaster in modern history. It is well documented. The only folks who aren't familiar with it are in the upper Amazon basins, rapidly fleeing the rest of humanity. I need not define Y2K for you to know exactly what I'm referencing. My July 6, 1998 column detailed why Y2K could not hurt the stock market. Because it was an old argument and well discounted, the S&P 500 in 1999 had a back-end rise during the supposed crisis with a total return for the year of 21%. Using this simple rule, anyone could have known Y2K wouldn't bite. Fear of Y2K was bullish, but few knew because they couldn't get themselves to embrace the rule. 4. Any category of security that was hot in the last 5 years won't be in the next 5 years. And vice versa. Still true. Though the actual number of years matters less. Things can be hot for a long time, but they won't be hot forever, and yet, investors still fall prey to this one. Energy in 1980. Tech in 2000. You can play this game endlessly. That they were hot in the last five doesn't mean they will be the coldest in the next five, or even necessarily cold at all. But no category stays hot forever. And if one did one day, it would be a double warning to seek safer and higher future returning turf elsewhere. Follow these four steps whenever you are presented with an investment decision, and you'll be better armed to ignore the noise and see what others find unseeable. Investment professionals, professional discounters. Another great source of discounted information are investment professionals, stockbrokers, financial planners, CPAs, CFAs, etc. Precious few have access to any information their peers or even a client with a fast modem doesn't have. Whatever they focus on, you shouldn't waste time on. If they're writing about it, focus elsewhere. Universities teach largely the same curriculum to their students in finance and economics. They're teaching pretty much from the same playbook. They're supposed to. The textbooks, methodologies, and theories taught are widely available. They contain little many tens of thousands of others can't read, learn, and thereby discount into markets. Decades of students have learned all this and been trained to think in these ways with the curriculum as their guide. It is basic to the craft. Every bit of what is taught is known by so many people that the curriculum, while fine, offers nothing others don't know. It offers nothing as a way to process information that isn't already in prices by the actions of the very large number of market participants who use the curriculum as the glasses through which they see the world. It's the way they were taught to see the world. Hence, it's in pricing. One very hard fact for craftsmen to accept is the curriculum itself is widely known and hence discounted into pricing. There is nothing wrong with learning it, but it doesn't teach you something others don't know. If professionals, as a group, have the same education, look at the same information, and interpret it largely the same way, where is their edge? What unique information do they think they have? The answer is most often, none. This is why, along with the media, professionals are useful in figuring out what information is priced and can be safely set aside. Friends don't let friends be contrarians. The media is generally wrong. Professionals likely don't have an edge because they're looking at the same widely known information everyone else has. Following the herd is fraught with peril. Does this mean you should do the exact opposite of what you hear from pundits and professionals? Should you become a classic contrarian? Absolutely not. No, no, and no. I'm frequently called a contrarian, but I'm not. Not as that term is generally used. Of course, I've been called far worse and will be, but the contrarian label happens to be wrong. Contrarianism has become increasingly popular in recent decades, rendering it priced by the market just as much as the consensus view. We are all contrarians now, and none of us are. Being contrarian will get you about as far in the long term as being wholly influenced in your investment decisions by the New York Times and the nightly news. The word contrarian implies going against the crowd. If folks are bullish, a classic contrarian becomes bearish, and vice versa. If everyone thinks electing a given politician is good for stocks, the contrarian sees it as bad. Technically, a contrarian correctly knows what everyone assumes will happen likely won't, but wrongly assumes the exact reverse will happen. Let's wade further into this. The market is a pretty efficient discounter of all known information. So, as we stated multiple times, if people tend to agree something will happen to markets, it typically won't. something else likely happens instead. But that doesn't mean the something else that happens is the exact reverse. Suppose most folks agree the market will go up. That doesn't mean it will go down. It might, but it might also go nowhere, which would also make everyone wrong. Or it might go up, but a lot more than anyone expects. That, too, would make everyone wrong. Over history, all those things have happened, and in about equal proportions. If you're a classic contrarian and correctly see most folks agree the market will go up, so you bet it will go down, and then it goes up, but much more than most folks expected, you end up the most wrong guy in town. Being a contrarian is better than betting with the crowd, but not much, and will still have you being right something on the shy side of one time in three. Think of this like a compass. The consensus thinks the market will go north. Contrarians think it will go south. But it could just as well go east or west, or northeast or southwest, making the crowd wrong and the contrarians wrong and the discounting mechanism work. Because those other outcomes are less expected than the contrarian position, they actually happen more often. The key is to remember something else typically happens than what the consensus expects, but not necessarily the reverse. True contrarians these days aren't much more right than consensus followers. It is surprise that shifts demand, which drives prices. The problem is the surprise could come from any direction. Patterns, patterns everywhere. To know something others don't, you must focus away from the noise. Ask what you can come to know that others can't. But how can you know about a thing you don't know? There are patterns to be discovered everywhere. Granted, many are simply meaningless, but there is so much out there we haven't discovered yet, people will make new capital markets discoveries for many decades to come. There is no reason you shouldn't find your share. If you seek them out, there are many patterns you can discover on your own before the rest of the investing world becomes aware, and there is your edge, your basis for a market bet. Essentially, you seek one of two things when asking question two. First, you want a pattern, some sort of correlation, between two or more variables people generally think are wholly unrelated. Second, you're looking for a pattern many people see but disregard, deride, or misinterpret. We show you two such examples here, and more in later chapters. The shocking truth about yield curves. You can't turn on the news without hearing about interest rates. Yet, despite all the attention interest rates garner, many miss a remarkable pattern and life lesson. Before we delve into remarkable patterns and causal correlation, let's clear the air regarding interest rates. Interest rates determine the cost to borrow, either short-term or long-term. They also determine the yield investors can get in return for locking up their liquid assets for a predetermined time period. How often have you either heard or read, interest rates are falling, or the Fed is raising interest rates, or some such news regarding interest rates? Rates, plural. Folks tend to mix up the rates monopoly controlled by a country's central bank, in America the Federal Reserve, aka the Fed, and market set rates. If America's Fed feels it should reduce or increase money supply, one tactic is to raise or lower, respectively, the federal funds target rate. The Federal Open Market Committee, FOMC, meets 8 times yearly to discuss if it should raise, lower, or stay the Fed funds rate, also sometimes referred to as the overnight rate or the short rate, and how much the rate should move, if at all. The short rate is that at which banks lend to each other and drives the interest rate banks pay you for deposits, savings accounts, and certificates of deposit, CDs. This is the rate, singular, investors mean to imply when they talk about the Fed monkeying around with rates. Rates on U.S. Treasuries and all other bond rates aren't set by the Fed, the government, the president, or an evil conspiracy. Those rates are set by global market forces. As a point of trivia, in the industry, the 10-year U.S. Treasury rate is sometimes referred to as the long rate. In our contemporary global economy, traders reach across country lines to trade bonds in a global free and open market. Make no mistake, though investors blather about rates falling and rates rising and the Fed raising rates, the Fed-controlled short rate and all other rates, treasuries, other sovereign debt, corporate bonds, municipal bonds, etc., move independently of each other, sometimes in the same direction and other times in opposing directions. Let's say that again differently. Sometimes when the Fed raises the Fed funds rate, other rates rise too. Other times, they fall. More often, they do a mix of things. Differing maturities on different types of bonds move up or down or stay flat to varying degrees. That is true in America and everywhere else. For those very new to this topic, the difference between the shortest-term Treasury bill, which is a very short-term rate, not the short rate, and varying longer-rate maturities can be plotted visually on a graph, resulting in a yield curve. The same can be done with any other form of bonds as long as they're the same type and credit quality. You can do corporate bond yield curves, muni bond yield curves, etc. The vertical axis plots interest rates from zero at the bottom to higher rates up top. The horizontal axis plots time from now at the left to longer-term maturities stretching out to the right, with the far right being 10 or 30 years into the future. Shorter-term rates usually tend to be lower than long-term rates, while longer-term rates tend to be higher in return for taking the additional risk of locking money away for longer periods. When short-term rates are lower, the curve slopes upward and is positive. Sometimes, rarely, shorter-term rates are actually higher than long-term rates. When this happens, our graph slopes downward to the right and is inverted. Still rare, but less so than an inverted yield curve, is when rates are all at about the same level. This is referred to as flat. The interest rate brouhaha. You may have heard an age-old mythology phrased, "Don't fight the Fed," which is meant to prompt you to sell stocks when the Fed raises the short rate. Nonsense. On average, stocks have done perfectly fine when the Fed raised the short rate, although not always. But nothing is always one way or the other. The S&P 500 and a rising Fed funds rate correlate pretty closely at times. I wouldn't take that to mean anything. The stock market is generally more positive than negative, so there is no surprise here. And sometimes the market was more positive than at others. But because positive markets have followed a rising short rate, "Don't fight the Fed" is rendered one of those question one myths you should ignore. This isn't to say a rising short rate is any kind of bull or bear market indicator, but neither is a dropping short rate. There is no credible, consistent link between the short rate moving any direction and bull or bear markets. What are Fed fighting fans missing? The first step in asking a successful question too is setting aside any unproductive fretting about concerns that don't matter. Anyone can Google the FOMC or go to the website, http://www.federalreserve.gov/FOMC/#calendars, and see when they're meeting. What's more, the FOMC under both Greenspan and Bernanke has become ever more transparent about when it plans to lower or raise the Fed funds rate, and by nearly exactly how much. The Fed raising the rate a quarter of a point, or even half a point, is hardly a market-moving event when the Fed has been talking about the planned pace of rate moves for months. Instead of focusing on short rate movements, focus on the yield curve. Most investors will tell you a positive yield curve is good and an inverted one is bad. That's more or less true. The yield curve is normally positively sloped. A truly inverted yield curve is rare and has a reputation for being bearish. But right now you're thinking about yield curves incorrectly, and it can hurt you. Before we can discover something new, let's check if what we believe about yield curves is correct with question one. Is it true an inverted yield curve is a harbinger of doom? The answer is, it depends on what you mean by yield curve, or more specifically, where. One problem behind the yield curve, I won't call it a myth so much as a misunderstanding, is folks tend to lump recessions and bear markets together. They're not the same things. You can have a bear market without a recession, and vice versa, though they do tend to come together because the stock market will price in doer sentiment and falling earnings caused by a recession. But it doesn't always. For example, if the recession is long feared and well priced. A moment for two definitions. A bear market is a prolonged stock market downturn exceeding 20% or so. The difference between a bear market and a correction is magnitude and duration. A correction being much shorter lived, only months, and usually under 20% or so. By contrast, a recession is generally defined as two consecutive quarters of negative GDP growth. But it's tough to know if you're in a recession while it's happening, since GDP numbers get heavily restated afterward. Two mildly negative quarters of GDP can be difficult to feel as they occur. Recessions usually aren't labeled recessions until long after they've started. Sometimes, not until after they're over. For example, the 1973 to 1974 bear market was followed immediately by a recession that was steep and pervasive throughout 1974, extending into 1975. It was one of the biggest of the post-World War II era, yet wasn't recognized as having happened until 1975. Meanwhile, in September 1974, President Ford and his economic advisors were still calling for tax hikes to slow the economy and fight inflation. That's because no one knew we were in a recession. While I was pretty darned young at the time, I remember the period very well. For me, it was a strange time. What I remember was all the people I talked to in 1974 thought the economy was strong, when later we'd learn it had been declining all year. In many ways, I wasn't very sensitive or plugged in that year. My wife and I had just lost our young daughter. I was pretty well shattered and capable of working only part-time for about 6 months. I didn't trust myself to have a good view of what was happening with the economy, so I spent a lot of time asking others what they thought was going on. Without intending to, I did a pretty good job of polling a big cross-section of investors and business people. Pretty much no one knew in 1974 we were already long in recession. I don't think much of anyone saw it as a recession until 1975, and by then, it was mostly over. And that was a huge one. It was heavily masked by the high level of inflation then. For many firms, revenues remained strong as unit volume shrank. Still, if few saw it, note how few would see a mild economic decline. The official measure of recession comes from the National Bureau of Economic Research, NBER, www.nber.com. Their definition captures more data, though one prominent data point is GDP, and more accurately characterizes an economic contraction. The NBER characterizes a recession thusly. The NBER does not define a recession in terms of two consecutive quarters of decline in real GDP. Rather, a recession is a significant decline in economic activity spread across the economy, lasting more than a few months, normally visible in real GDP, real income, employment, industrial production, and wholesale retail sales. Historically, a steep yield curve suggests an environment in which financial institutions can lend profitably, and lending is an important driver of future economic activity. However, an inverted yield curve creates a disincentive for banks to lend, thereby reducing liquidity. Remember this for later in this chapter, and it's a fairly reliable predictor of recessions. But whether an inverted yield curve causes a bear market or not depends on whether the related bad news is priced into the market. For example, in 1998, we had a flattening yield curve here in America that had people in a collective tizzy. Fear of an upcoming inverted yield curve ran rampant. That, along with the Russian ruble crisis and the long-term capital management crisis, was widely expected to drive stocks down, long and hard. We had a big mid-year correction, but no bear market. The S&P 500 finished 1998 up 29%. Fear of a flattening yield curve was so prevalent, it lost its power to create a major decline. Fast forward to 2000, when the yield curve actually did invert. This time, nobody paid heed. Instead, folks were lauding the new economy and saying earnings don't matter and it's different this time, as they rushed off to parties celebrating the launch of dot-com stocks. Among other things, the recent memory of 1998 may have convinced them inverted yield curves didn't matter. In 2000, the yield curve, because it wasn't widely noted and feared, the tribe was looking elsewhere, was a good harbinger of economic weakness and peaking tech stock prices that led to a 3-year bear market. If everyone is talking about it, dreading it, and stocking up on canned goods because of it, then the inverted yield curve has likely lost some of its bearish oomph. If everyone skips about singing tra-la-la, it's different this time, as in early 2000, then the inverted yield curve can devastate stocks. Even with that clarified, people still see yield curves incorrectly. It's important we see them correctly because of the economic conditions an inverted yield curve implies. You think about interest rates here in America and the yield curve they engender. Why wouldn't you think about U.S. interest rates? What other interest rates would you consider? The question too I'm about to share can be recast over and over again into other problem-solving contexts where it works just as well. So, here goes. Question 2. Is there a yield curve more important than America's? You've probably never thought to ask yourself that question. Why on earth would you? What could possibly be more important than America, particularly to Americans? After all, when we look at U.S. yield curves from 30, 50, and 100 years ago, we can see some pretty compelling long-standing evidence they can signal how healthy the economy is. Everyone knows that, or at least plenty of folks believe it, including most reporters, which means pretty much everyone. It's widely accepted America's yield curve matters and is a somewhat reliable indicator of good and bad economic times ahead. Whenever the short rate has been above long-term rates, banks become disinterested in lending as aggressively. And that's less good. 30 years ago, when America's yield curve inverted, the only way for a bank to make money lending was to lend to a worse credit risk at a higher rate than the bank's borrowing costs. This was and is risky, and banks dislike doing it. In fact, the riskier the customer they need to profitably lend, the less they like it and don't want to do it. In the days of yore, America's yield curve and its camber mattered. A lot. Of course, in those days, most folks didn't know the yield curve mattered. Think globally. Think better. Fast forward to now. We have not just national banks, but fully global banks, a wide array of derivatives and financial futures for hedging, and electronics, allowing instant access to precise accounting and trade information globally. Now money flows fairly freely across borders. A global bank can borrow in one country and lend in another and hedge its currency risk all as fast as you can read this sentence. I can borrow money from an investment bank that got it from a syndicate of insurance firms in Europe that crossed the money through global banks, and I may never know the source was overseas. To me, as the borrower, it's just money. Decades back, in a world of national banks, minimal high-volume electronics for accounting and trading, no material hedging instruments and fixed instead of flexible currency prices, it was the national yield curve that mattered. No more. Global tendencies prevail over local ones in every country, including America, the greatest country in the world. Foreign interest rates and yield curves provide or deny liquidity, heavily impacting our own. They also determine the cost-effectiveness of using leverage as a means to snap up both domestic and foreign assets. The analysis of any country's yield curve, even a country as massive as America, has become less meaningful. The right way to think about this now, something I fathomed no one had ever written about before I first did, is the GDP-weighted global yield curve. The global yield curve is representative of worldwide lending conditions. In today's world, if the global yield curve says one thing and America's says another, go with the global. America's or any other single stock market will subordinate to the global curve. The reason it's important? If a bank can borrow more cheaply in one country and lend more profitably in another, it will. Everybody, including banks and their customers, likes cheap money. It makes sense intuitively that a country with a larger GDP would have greater impact on the global yield curve. In constructing the GDP-weighted yield curve, first, I made a list of the countries included in the MSCI World Index. I didn't use the full list of ACWI countries because the developed nations' GDPs dwarf those of the emerging nations, so their interest rates would barely register. And accurate data on some emerging nations is devilishly tough to come by. Then, I input the latest GDP for each of the countries. The GDP for all of these countries can be found at the website for the International Monetary Fund. IMF. www.imf.org. My list went something like this. Country. GDP, dollars and billions. GDP, weight, percentage. Country A. $50 billion in GDP. Weight, 14.3%. Country B. $50 billion in GDP. Weight, 14.3%. Country C. $250 billion in GDP. Weight, 71.4%. Total, $350 billion in GDP. Clearly, that is all hypothetical information and a shorter list for illustration's sake, but you get the idea. To get each country's appropriate GDP weight, sum for the total world GDP, and divide for each country. Next, input the short-term and long-term interest rates. Here, I add the 3-month and the 10-year rates. I have access to some great data sources letting me compile interest rates quickly, but anyone can find this information for free on any good financial website. Country A. 3-month rate, 3.25. 10-year rate, 6.5. Country B. 3-month rate, 2.5. 10-year rate, 7.2. Country C. 3-month rate, 4.5. 10-year rate, 4.25. That part is just data entry. Now, I subtract the 3-month rate from the 10-year rate to get the spread. A positive spread means a positive yield curve, and a negative spread means an inverted curve. Country A. 6.5 minus 3.25 equals a spread of 3.25. Country B. 7.2 minus 2.5 equals a spread of 4.70. Country C, 4.25 minus 4.5 equals a spread of negative 0.25. Note, country C actually has a negative spread, meaning its yield curve has inverted slightly, and country C has a massive relative GDP. Does this spell doom for country C? We aren't done yet. Next, multiply each country's spread by the appropriate GDP weight and sum up the column for the global yield curve spread. Country A, GDP weighted spread, 0.46. Country B, GDP weighted spread, 0.67. Country C, GDP weighted spread, negative 0.18. Totaling 0.95. Though country C has a negative yield curve, the global yield curve is still positively sloped. The 10-year is above the 3-month. The global yield curve spread is 0.95, a spread from low to high of almost exactly 1%. You can imagine country C with a much bigger GDP than its friends on this imaginary index is a country like the United States. The other countries' yield curves matter too, even to a country as big as country C. If credit conditions are suboptimal for country C's banks and institutions, they can borrow in other countries without feeling much of a slowdown, which is not what they would have done decades ago. You can use the same methodology to calculate the global short-term and long-term rates if you want to create an actual global yield curve. Just multiply each country's interest rate by its GDP weighting, then sum up for the global rate. In our hypothetical example, the global 3-month rate is 4.04 and the 10-year rate is 4.99. Subtracting the shorter-term rate, you still arrive at the same yield curve spread of 0.95. Therefore, an inverted U.S. yield curve by itself is no basis for immediate panic. Rather, you must look at what global rates and the global curve are doing. An inverted yield curve in a single nation when the global curve is positive might be a reason to underweight that country. But it's no surefire reason to get globally bearish, not by a long shot. The global yield curve is a more useful leading indicator for stocks and the global economy than any single country's curve. As global as you can get. In measuring global markets, the best indexes we have currently are those built by MSCI, Inc. All MSCI indexes are properly constructed, in other words, market capitalization and float-weighted. But the two we focus on most are the MSCI World Index and MSCI All-Country World Index. The World Index and ACWI for brevity's sake. The World Index represents 24 developed nations, including America, Britain, Australia, Germany, and Japan. I frequently refer to the World Index when discussing market history because it provides ample historical data, and having data to measure helps decipher history. More important, it is comprehensive, and each constituent is weighted by its float, that is, its market liquidity. That is, a stock has little market effect if it's not trading actively. One example is Berkshire Hathaway, which isn't included in the World Index or the S&P 500 because it's so seldom traded relative to other stocks. As a proxy for the total global market, another good choice is the ACWI, as it also includes emerging nations. Currently, 45 countries make the cut. The stocks in the World Index plus Mexico, Brazil, China, India, and so on. Because there is limited history and little data for the emerging markets, it's less useful than the World Index for measuring performance history, but it's a well-constructed index and an excellent proxy for the global market. To find more information on these indexes and track historical performance, go to www.msci.com. Considering the spread between global short-term rates and global long-term rates since 1985 is another way of depicting the relative steepness of the global yield curve. Anything above 0% is a positive yield curve, and anything below is inverted. The higher the line, the greater the spread between short-term and long-term rates, and hence, the steeper the curve. The global yield curve inverted in 1989, signaling the oncoming recession. A global recession, by the way. It also got very flat at the end of 2000 and early in 2007, both ahead of global recessions. Recall at points in 2005 and 2006, the U.S. yield curve was very flat or even inverted, depending on how you measured. Inverted. But in 2005 and 2006, the global yield curve was still positive, and there was no U.S. or global recession then. Interestingly, U.S. stocks rose 4.9% and 15.8% in 2005 and 2006, respectively, lagging world stocks both years, which rose 9.5% and 20.1%. Such an outcome wouldn't surprise you if you knew the U.S. had inverted, but the world had not. If the global yield curve is inverted or flat, be cognizant of what that could mean looking forward. Whether positive or inverted, it should be more important to your global view than any single nation yield curve. To my knowledge, until I did it, no one ever constructed a GDP-weighted global yield curve to summarize global credit conditions. This is a simple and perfect example of a question two, fathoming what is unfathomable to most people. The global, not national, yield curve is more important today. And yet, fathoming what is unfathomable to most people isn't complicated, prohibitively theoretical, or hard to grasp. It's actually pretty darned basic and simple. One really neat point mentioned earlier is you can extend this principle to many other phenomena. It's the global budget deficit that matters, or doesn't, to global GDP and markets. It's the global level of inflation that will drive inflation in America and elsewhere. You can use the same methodology I just described to create a GDP-weighted global money supply and watch its growth. Why? Because it's global money creation that will drive global inflation, not what any single country does. You know you worry about trade deficits and current account deficits. By definition, these simply disappear on a global level, but we cover how to think about that later. You can apply global thinking to so many things that the age-old but seldom-applied notion of think global, act local is a truly valuable saw. One, way ahead of its time. What the yield curve is trying to tell you. Now, you're thinking about yield curves correctly and can begin looking for other remarkable patterns and another basis for a market bet. Another question too. What is it the yield curve can tell you about stocks? No one else knows. By now, you know, or you should know if you don't, all investment styles cycle in and out of favor. We talk more about why in later chapters. No one size or style leads for all time. More noticeably, no predictable pattern exists to indicate which size or style will lead next. If you buy the previous year's winner, you very often end up with this year's loser, except for an unusual lengthy period of leadership in the late 1990s for large-cap U.S. stocks. Of course, you were then rewarded for your heat chasing with a long period of miserable performance starting in 2000. As I said, styles pretty much are never hot for 10 years. If a pattern existed indicating when to change equity categories, how could all the smart people who've been investing through all these years have missed it? Pretty easily. For example, in 1987, after the yield curve steepened significantly to nearly 2.5 percentage points of spread, value stocks assumed leadership and outperformed growth for the rest of the decade by an impressive 28%. Then the yield curve flattened and inverted, The growth took over leadership until the yield curve steepened again. The pattern repeats itself, sometimes with longer periods of leadership and even more decisive outperformance, 55% and 76%. Investors who fret over not fighting the Fed or worry about interest rates being too high or too low miss this remarkable pattern. Generally, when the global yield curve is at its widest, that tends to be a period when value outperforms. Value tends to start outperforming before the peak is reached because stocks move first. After all, the market is a discounter. It's not perfect because no one thing is a silver bullet and capital markets are intensely complex. In fact, the pattern falls apart a bit in the period starting in 2007. Based on the yield curve, you might expect value to outperform. The spread between short and long rates got very wide globally. However, this period included the 2008 credit crisis and bear market, which hit financial stocks severely. Financials stocks tend to be value-oriented, so their big underperformance helped drag down value overall. Ignoring financials performance during this period, value actually did outperform by 4.9%. But if you could have predicted financials' huge underperformance and the bear market, you likely wouldn't have needed the value growth trade-off to do well during this period. Again, recall no one thing is a perfect predictor of moving forward, even if it's worked well and consistently in the past. However, the fundamentals behind when and why value wants to outperform relative to growth and vice versa haven't changed. More on that in a bit. So, if you could know when the yield curve wanted to get very steep, that could be a good time to favor value stocks. And if you knew the yield curve wanted to flatten, that would be a strong reason to favor growth. What's more, the difference in performance between the styles can be significant. Plus, the periods tend to last for a while, so you needn't time this perfectly, which would be near impossible to do anyway. But you need the global yield curve to see this right. Unless you've been to a seminar given by me or my firm, you've probably never seen yield curve spread and performance of value and growth stocks overlaid this way. Nobody sees this pattern, and yet, the relationship is remarkable, and for good reason. You see the connection between a yield curve spike and value outperforming, and a flattening or flat yield curve and growth taking over leadership most of the time. But so what? As said before, there are many existing patterns that don't necessarily mean anything. Before you go off half-cocked and make serious portfolio changes based on a pattern, you must check your pattern for causality. Without a causal correlation, you have no basis for a bet. If something is causal, if something happens because of something else, then they're always correlated to some degree. But two correlated variables won't always be causal. When you took statistics in school, they told you high correlation doesn't necessarily mean causality, but causality does mean high correlation. The essence of a question two is looking first for high correlations and then seeing if you can justify causality tied to simple economics. Two events can show correlation by accident or coincidence. By definition, the same thing. This is the gambler's fallacy in reverse. Every time you flip a coin, you have a 50-50 chance of getting heads, no matter if the previous 100 flips resulted in heads. Just because you have evidence of Y happening with some regularity after you observe Q a number of times, you can't bet it will happen again, no more than you have better odds the 101st flip is tails. If Y follows Q often, but you can't sort out good economics behind the correlation, go back to the drawing board. There might be something else happening when you observe Q that is really causing Y, and you must figure out what the mystery variable is. X, perhaps? Before you start placing bets, Or you might simply have found a statistical freak. Statistics can be freaky. If you have correlation without causality, you have nothing. Your discoveries must make basic economic sense before they're useful. What if you measure Q seeming to cause Y, and what's more, it makes sense? But you observe Q leading to Y only 70% or 80% of the time. Should you abandon this tool? No way! In investing, 100% correlation never happens. There are so many market pressures, so many moving maybes. If you wait for 100% correlation, you'll never make a market bet. If something is correlated 70% of the time, that's huge. You can worry about the other 30% later. Often, in life, Y is caused 70% by Q and 30% by X, or X plus L, and is simply multifactorial. Still, a 70% correlation with good causality is great. If you could bet steadily winning 70% of the time, you would blow away all professional investors in no time. All. If you can show Q causes Y with some regularity and it makes economic sense, when no one else has a clue what causes Y, you have found something big. Growth and value. What's the difference? What's growth? What's value? How do you know? First, neither growth nor value as a category is provably better or has much different risk characteristics over ultra-long periods, but they cycle in and out of favor. Pretty much everyone agrees growth stocks have higher PEs and value stocks lower. But higher or lower than what? Some professionals pick an arbitrary level and stick with it. In my view, it's better to be guided by your benchmark, the index you compare yourself to. Find the forward PE of your benchmark. Stocks with a higher PE than the benchmark will have more growth characteristics. Stocks with a lower PE will have more value characteristics. Stocks close to the benchmark PE are basically, for you, style neutral. Keep that in mind, because your benchmark's average PE will bounce around a bit. The more of a growth bias you want, the higher you need your portfolio's average PE to be relative to your benchmark's PE. Same for value, but in reverse. And there may very well be times when you want to be essentially style neutral. It's also important to remember some companies may temporarily have no earnings and no PE. For these, you need some other metric, like the price-to-book ratio or the price-to-sales ratio. You can use the same methodology with either of these ratios and find similar results. So, does the change in yield curve spread correlating to whether value or growth leads the market link to any basic economics? Absolutely. It stems from how corporations raise capital and how much incentive banks have to lend that capital. Banking's core business is, and always has been, borrowing short-term money as the basis on which it makes long-term loans. In the industry vernacular, it's borrowing short and lending long. The difference between the short rate and the long rates is effectively the bank's gross operating profit margin on the next loan it makes. The steeper the curve, the greater the profit banks can reap on lending. As the curve flattens, banks make less of a profit on the next loan. If the curve goes inverted, banks don't feel much incentive to lend at all, which is why an inverted curve can be so bearish. Recall, banks must seek riskier loans to make a profit in this environment, and banks don't like writing loans likely to default. The yield curve spread determines banking system propensity or eagerness to lend. If you're a bank CEO faced with a steep yield curve and have any sense at all, you want to encourage your loan officers to lend. When the curve gets very steep, they get very eager. When it gets flat, they get less eager. It isn't any more complicated than that in figuring out eagerness to lend. Value companies raise capital, by and large, through the use of debt. They leverage themselves to acquire other companies, build a plant, expand their product line, increase their marketing reach, or what have you. When the yield curve is steep and banks have an additional incentive to lend, they're more prone to lend to value companies. We see why in a moment. And value companies and their stockholders typically benefit. On the flip side, growth companies raise capital, by and large, through the issuance of new stock. They can borrow money too, and do, but they can also issue stock, and it's usually cheaper for them to do so. Again, we see why soon. When the yield curve flattens, banks have less incentive to lend because their profit margin gets skinnier on the next loan or disappears entirely. But investment bankers still have a terrific incentive to help growth companies issue new stock because initial public offerings, IPOs, and new stock issuances are supremely profitable for them. Consequently, in this environment, value companies typically begin to fall out of favor and growth takes over leadership. The growth companies now have ample opportunities to raise capital to fuel higher earnings just when the value companies can't raise capital as easily. On the flip side, let's flip it. Again, when you can't fathom something, reframing or flipping it around so you see it differently often helps. Let's flip PEs to see this right. You know growth stocks typically have higher PEs than value stocks, by definition, and they tend to have loftier public images as great firms. Suppose some growth stock has a PE of 50 and some value stock has a PE of 5. You know the PE of 50 is really $50 of price divided by $1 of earnings, and the PE of 5 is $5 of price divided by $1 of earnings. Now, flip them into an EP, and you have the earnings yield, discussed in Chapter 1. The 50 flipped becomes 2%. If the company's accounting is accurate and its earnings are stable, that 2% is effectively its after-tax cost. Remember, the PE was after tax, so the EP is 2. If raising expansion capital by selling stock, a low cost compared to borrowing long-term debt at corporate bond rates, the company with the PE of 5 has an EP of 20%, a very high after-tax cost of raising expansion capital compared to borrowing long-term debt through bonds. Said again, the growth company will be prone, whenever it can, to raise expansion capital cheaply by selling stock. The value company won't. It will want to get expansion capital by borrowing money to the extent it can. Let's flip and reframe again. Instead of being a corporate borrower or stock issuer, you are a bank loan officer. You've got 4 loan customers. 1. Microsoft, a famous big-cap growth company. 2. Ford, a famous big-cap value company. 3. GeeWizotronics, a not-famous small-cap growth company. 4. Local County Cement, a not-famous small-cap value stock. These 4 are your only customers, and each has borrowed the same amount from you. Pretend these loans were issued so you could call them back in, forcing the borrower to pay them off whenever you want. One day your bank president comes in and tells you it's no longer profitable for the bank to have so many loans. He tells you to pull in 25% of your loan base by cutting off one of your customers, your choice. Who do you cut off? Well, you don't cut off Microsoft, generally regarded as one of the world's greatest companies. If you did, all the good old boys at the Loan Officers Club would laugh at you. You don't much want to cut off Ford either. It isn't quite up to Microsoft's image for quality, but it's a pretty big name. Cut off GeeWizotronics? Nah, It's small, but it's rumored to be growing fast. Maybe it will be the next Microsoft. If you cut it off, again, folks will laugh at you when, if, gee whiz actually whizzes. The one you cut off is small cap value, local county cement. Doggy, stodgy, been there forever, but if construction dries up, its profits do too. No seeming growth potential. This decision is easy. You keep Microsoft, Ford, and G-Wizatronics, and cut off local county cement. The good old boys won't laugh at you for that. In effect, what have we done? We've deprived capital from the value side, primarily smaller value, though you were tempted to ding the big boy, Ford, and maybe you will next time, but not growth. Local County Cement had been planning to expand but now must scrap those plans, and hence, its stock tanks. Looking forward, it can be nothing but defensive and must live mainly from cash flow without access to any expansion capital other than what it produces through profits. Meanwhile, growth stocks can get expansion capital by selling stock since they have high PEs and low EPs. They keep growing and looking good to investors. In fact, the high PE firm can grow right then and there if it wants by selling some cheap stock and launching the expansion into cement that local county cement previously intended, eating its lunch. Flip it again. Fast forward 3 years. You've been living happily with your three loan customers, but one day, your boss walks in and says the lending environment has become much more profitable and he needs you to expand your loan portfolio. The yield curve is really steep and the bank will make fat gross operating profit margins on the next loan you make. So go out there and make a loan, Johnson, he orders you. My name isn't Johnson, you mutter to yourself, but nonetheless, you call Microsoft. It doesn't want to borrow any more because it just floated some stock. Ford has already borrowed beyond what a drunken sailor on leave could consume and is figuratively lying unconscious on the factory floor. G-Wizatronics just laughs at you because it's planning an upcoming stock offering at 1,200 times future earnings and doesn't want to be seen talking to a banker for fear it could hurt its offering. And suddenly, you get this weird idea. There was that local cement company, Local County Cement. You call and offer to lend them money. The CEO falls out of his chair because no one has spoken to him in years. He calls downstairs to the CFO's basement office and says, Ed, remember those expansion plans we put on the back shelf a few years ago? Dust them off and get them up here. There's some crazy banker wants to lend us money, and suddenly we can grow just like we're G-Wizatronics. Actually, Local County Cement probably won't grow like G-Wizatronics might, but it can become more growth-like with financing than without it. Hence, the swing in the yield curve determines when the bank lends to Local County Cement and when it won't, and when the stock will be priced more like a growth company, or more like dead meat, or old, cold concrete. This hypothetical anecdote shows the simple economics behind why shifts in the global yield curve, which reflect banking system propensity to lend, define when growth stocks and value stocks want to alternate in lending and lagging the market. Pretty simple. Now you have a correlation pattern supported by economics. Very fundamental. What's more, your fellow investors aren't thinking about how the yield curve impacts corporations in their quest for capital and how that, in turn, impacts market returns. They're probably not even thinking about the yield curve correctly to begin with. The answer to this question, too, gives you a rational basis for a market bet. Understanding when growth and value are likelier to cycle in and out of favor. Keep an eye on global rates. They're a powerful guide. The presidential term cycle. how changes in yield curve spread impact the growth versus value trade-off is easy to see with data and makes sense. No advanced degree in finance or statistics required, just publicly available data and an Excel spreadsheet, or even some graph paper. As we learned in Chapter 1, if you need fancy engineered equations, your hypothesis is probably wrong. But what if you discover a pattern that is tough to prove with data, though it makes tremendous sense? And what if the pattern is fairly predictable? Here's an example. Consider presidents going back to 1925 and the subsequent annual returns on the S&P 500, which go back to 1926. By splitting the first 2 years of the presidential term from the last 2 years, you can find, for the most part, the last 2 years of the presidential cycle tend to be positive. Disregard the years 1929 to 1932. You will remember these years as the beginning of the Great Depression, a period unlikely to be repeated anytime soon due to extensive banking and market reform, and much knowledge we didn't have back then about how economies and central banking work. Otherwise, you get only 4 other negative years in the back halves of presidents' terms. Negative, a scant 0.4%. 1939 wasn't such a bad year. Even 1940 was negative just 10.1%, down, but not down huge. Plus, those years being negative ought not shock you since the market was discounting the beginning of World War II. The year 2000 was pretty odd as well. After the terrific bull run of the 1990s, we experienced the tech bubble bursting. Plus, late in the year, there was a near-constitutional crisis surrounding the presidential election. Interestingly, a lot of people remember 2000 as the first time we had a president elected who didn't win the popular vote. Except we often have a president elected without a majority of the popular vote. And Al Gore, despite media commentary to the contrary, didn't win a majority of the popular vote in 2000. He carried 48%. Bill Clinton never did because of minority candidates like Ross Perot and later Ralph Nader. Abraham Lincoln didn't win a majority of the 1860 popular vote. He only got 39.8%. But he did in 1864 with 55%. What people mean is Al Gore got more votes than George Bush. Neither won a majority of the popular vote in 2000, and they are in good company with John Kennedy in 1960 and Richard Nixon in 1968. Gore did win the most popular votes, but didn't win the Electoral College, which is the end game. That launched us into uncharted territory to determine the election's outcome as Gore challenged the Florida vote in court for its precious electoral votes. The challenge created uncertainty and increased the weirdness of year-end 2000. Markets hate uncertainty. To show you the effect of that, on September 1st, 2000, the S&P 500 was up 4.3% for the year. The negative year was likely heavily influenced by election uncertainty in the last quarter. And then there was the 2008 credit crunch, exacerbated or perhaps caused by a hugely problematic and thankfully now repealed accounting rule, FAS 157, Fair Value Accounting, and the government's haphazard response through that year. What we can say is, barring events of epic proportions, the back halves of presidential terms are historically periods when the stock market hasn't wanted to have negative returns. It's also obvious, as you look at these data, that the third year of a president's term has been the best, most uniformly positive, with the highest average returns. Knowing this can alleviate some anxiety as you attempt to forecast. You should be otherwise slightly biased toward bullish in the last 2 years in an election cycle. By contrast, market risk tends to concentrate in the first 2 years of a president's term, where yet another pattern emerges. When you do get a negative year in the first half, you usually, although not always, tend to get only one. If the first year is negative, the second year is usually not, and vice versa. While you do occasionally get two positive years in the first half, two negatives in a row are rare. Again, ignore 1929 and 1930 as Great Depression years, and therefore an anomaly. You also get a second negative year during Nixon's truncated second term, but that was a pretty darned weird time, too. You might find this bit of forecasting technology an assault on your intelligence. "Why, it's patently absurd and overtly simplistic," you might say. It is simple, and that's why it's so great. This pattern isn't hidden away, cloaked in mystery. It's right out there, in the open, plain and easy to see. You've probably already heard of the presidential term cycle. It is a term that is well known and typically censured as voodoo, although no one uses it like I'm prescribing, in my view. If everyone thought it a nifty tool, it would have become priced into the market and lost all its power. As long as folks continue to sneer at it, you know you have an edge. The Great Depression. It's important to note our Great Depression was part of a global Great Depression, and most historians miss that point endlessly. What you normally hear is the Great Depression was punishment rained on the United States for the Fed's banking missteps, individual and corporate greedy excesses, and Hoover's commitment to a laissez-faire government. While a great many mistakes were made in America, economic historians tend to paint our Great Depression as if it weren't part of a bigger, and therefore largely unavoidable, global phenomenon. For a whole series of discussions on the Great Depression as global phenomenon, see my second book, The Wall Street Waltz. Nobody can predict what a genuine phony will do. Strong trends not commonly observed or accepted are powerful. Even so, this one is a little hard to prove with raw data statistically. Calendar years don't work that way, but it makes tremendous economic sense. The market dislikes nothing so much as uncertainty, and a new president, even a newly re-elected president, presents the market with tremendous uncertainty. Among politics, the president is the big tick. The one who ultimately knows how to tick off the fewest people while getting elected and tick off the most afterward. If a politic is a phony, one capable of winning a presidential election is a genuine and most capable phony. No one can predict what a genuine phony will do next. George W. Bush thoughtfully violated a basic rule in 2002 all presidents have known. Their party almost always loses some relative power to the opposition party in Congress during the midterm elections. Bush was the first Republican president in more than 100 years to have his party gain seats in the midterms. And since a president knows his party is likely to lose relative power to the opposition in the midterms, the most onerous legislation he would hope to pass, the hardest to get through Congress, the landmark of his presidency, he must try to get passed in the first 2 years. If he can't get it legislated then, he certainly wouldn't be able to do so in the back half of his term. The biggest and ugliest attempts at redistribution of wealth, property rights, and regulatory status, which is also property rights, almost always have occurred in the first half of presidents' terms. Fundamental to capitalism itself and capital market stability is faith in the stability of property rights. We often take property rights for granted because America has the best, most perfected, and most stable system of property rights in the world's history. It is a key part going back to George Mason's fundamental force on the Founding Fathers, leading to America being so great a nation. Anything threatening the sanctity of property rights raises risk aversion and scares the heck out of capital markets. In the first year of his term, a president is in his honeymoon, eager to spend the political capital he earned during the election, rosy-cheeked, with a sparkle in his eye and his shiny family at his side. The new guy usually shoots out the gate trying to get his toughest stuff passed, this being the infamous first 100 days of a president's term when he lays out his agenda. The threat of those shifts in property rights or wealth redistribution historically have led to higher risk aversion and the first halves of president's terms being perfect loam for bear markets to propagate in. Hence, the first half of a president's term is generally marked with a busy legislative calendar and a disproportionate number of our bear markets. This doesn't mean the president's proposed legislation succeeds, mind you, but that he makes a go of it. And there is the risk he gets his agenda passed. And markets don't like that risk. Remember after Bill Clinton's 1992 election, he raised taxes in 1993. Though he had promised in his campaign to cut taxes, and then in 1994, he threatened to nationalize health care. A shift in property rights. All typical first-half politico tomfoolery of a genuine phony. With President Obama, the big agenda items happened in the front half. The back half, as I write, has been relatively very quiet. This is typical. Other times, as with President G.W. Bush, there was never a material legislative agenda proposed at all, not for either term. When there is, it's the grist of a disproportionate amount of our bear markets. Any new proposed legislation implies potential change and a reapportionment of your money and property rights. No matter what the government decides to do, no matter how wonderful the new programs may sound, no matter how incontrovertible the benefit is, new legislation means money and rights get shifted around. Low-cost prescriptions for the poor and elderly. Who could see that as bad? Stiffer penalties for society's worst offenders, pedophiles, rapists, and puppy stranglers? Sign me up. Free ponies for all children? You'd have to be a monster to oppose that. Whatever it is, Uncle Sam takes money or rights from one group, fusses around with them, and passes whatever is left to yet another group. We already know we hate losses more than we like gains. The group on the losing end of the transfer hates losing much more than those on the winning end of the transfer like winning. Those not party to the transfer watch it transpire and think they've just seen a mugging. Markets view redistribution of wealth or property rights like witnessing a mugging. It causes fear beyond the size of the action itself because it makes all witnesses realize they could be mugged next. Consequently, the market can be weak somewhere in the first 2 years because the market doesn't like politically forced change. By the third and fourth years, we know our president. He may be a politic, and we may dislike him, but he is our time-proven bloodsucker. There's not much left to surprise. We think we know what he's up to, what his agenda is, and how capable he is of getting anything done, or not. And sometimes not is a pretty good thing in a world that doesn't like forced political change. Moreover, presidents tend to avoid any potentially controversial legislation in the back half of their terms because either they are trying to get re-elected themselves or they're just tired and hanging on, which is often true in a president's seventh and eighth years. A particularly good politic will hang back in his third year, get little done, and at election time, blame his administration's ineffectiveness on politics from the opposing party. "I could have gotten you the free ponies I promised," he might intone, "had it not been for those uncooperative senators from that other damned party who opposed me. So get rid of those losers, vote for these other guys who support me, and next time I'll get you your free ponies." Quiet legislative years lead to happier markets. They almost never lead to free ponies. We're not done with presidential terms yet. Ask yourself, what else is going on no one notices or lends any credence? We know the first 2 years are where most of the market risk will likely be. Is there anything particularly remarkable about the first half of a second term for a re-elected president? Ignore all the first and single presidential terms. Again, you tend not to get two negatives in a row, except for that screwy Nixon. But when you don't get a negative year, you tend to get a big positive year. Positive years in the first 2 years of a re-elected president's term have averaged 21% and 24%, respectively, big, booming, positive years. These years typically are either negative or up big, extreme one way or the other, sort of barbell-like returns. Being on the right side of the market is more important and most keen in its impact during these years. This is a good example of looking beyond averages into what makes up the averages. The historic averages of first and second years of president's terms are below average, but within those averages you get a very wide spread between nasty years and pretty great years. Averages can be very deceiving. Technically, Teddy Roosevelt wasn't really re-elected in 1904 since he wasn't elected in the first place. Same for Truman in 1948 and Johnson in 1964. But I'm not really sure that matters to this phenomenon. All were the second terms of politics we already knew. Should you abandon all other forecasting efforts and let your political calendar be your one determining factor in your allocation of stocks, bonds, and cash? No! Beyond super silly! While the presidential term cycle is a trend and makes absolute socioeconomic sense, keep in mind there are many other market forces at work, including all the ones outside of America. For example, the U.S. markets correlate to foreign markets in our increasingly globalized economy. Foreign forces can and will impact America. Never assume you've found the one silver bullet. To summarize, market risk trends higher in the first half of president's terms. The back half tends to be positive, with the third year most positive. In the front half, when it isn't negative, it tends to be up big, and particularly so in second terms. Though that didn't happen in 2005 and 2006, it certainly did in 2009 and 2010. What's more, the tendency for non-negative years to be up big makes sense. Apprehension about political risk fading away can lead to elation, causing big positive years. Interestingly, as 2010 ended, a lot of folks started mentioning that 2011, being Obama's third year, would be a bullish force, which made me skeptical. Suddenly, a wave of folks believing in this technology could sap it of power. That, among other reasons, led me to forecast 2011 markets would be volatile but end overall flattish. In my January 26, 2011 Forbes column, I said, "My research now shows there are too many optimists out there. That's bearish. But wait, the research indicates that there are also too many pessimists lingering about, many long-time, heels-dug-in doomers, as well as newly converted acrophobics. They are fearful mostly because of the last 2 years' heady rise. That's bullish. It's a standoff between gloomers and bulls. A barbelled sentiment bifurcation. I've regularly referred to the market as the Great Humiliator, a nearly all-powerful spiritual entity existing solely to humiliate as many people as possible for as many dollars as possible for as long as possible. It's after you and me and your aged aunt. It now accomplishes its goal best by frustrating bulls and bears alike in a year where the stock market ends up or down just by a hair." And that's just what happened. U.S. and world stocks ended exceedingly flat for the full year, with lots of volatility along the way. My guess is 2011 being flat sapped belief in this pattern, which actually makes it powerful again. Not a silver bullet, nothing is, but a useful tool once again. Something like this is a simple example of fathoming something others can't or won't fathom. But if for whatever reason others start widely fathoming it, it won't work as well because it will be discounted into pricing. For still more ways to use the presidential term anomaly, see my 2010 book, Debunkery, and my 2011 book, Markets Never Forget. Test and test again. You may be surprised I'm sharing this with you. In this chapter and others, any of what I've come to believe, I know that others don't. Why give it away if I think I know something giving me an edge? Now, lots of people will know what I know, meaning it will soon be priced into markets and therefore not work anymore, right? Maybe. Maybe not. I've been talking and writing about presidential term cycles for a long time, and every time I do, someone looks for a giant butterfly net to haul me away. Just like my views on high PEs. People think I'm a kook for believing this works, which is how I know this little bit of technology still is powerful. The same is true for most other examples I share in this book. Once I've found something that works, I continually test it to make sure it hasn't become priced. Once I believe I've fathomed something new, I look to see if others can or will fathom it. One way I test it is by giving it away. The more people think it's nuts, the more they don't fathom what I find fathomable, and the more I know it likely still works. If they start embracing it, thinking it's good and not nuts, then it's less powerful. Maybe becomes obsolete. When an unfathomable becomes widely fathomable, it's time to abandon it and fathom new, unfathomable truths. The goal with question 2 is to know something now that might be common knowledge in 3 or 30 years. Once everyone knows your new piece of reality, it will no longer be useful to you, so test it. Ask your friends and colleagues if they were aware shifts in the yield curve signal a change in style leadership, and if there is any truth to the presidential term cycle. As long as the response is a blank look of, "What?" or, "That's crazy," or an even better, "You're crazy," you still have a basis for a bet. I give away some, not all, of the findings I've had over the years, so I know what I can safely continue using and what has outlived its usefulness. Far too many of my peers stick to repeating what they learn at the knee of their mentors and wonder why they can't beat the market. Winning at investing requires constant innovation and constant testing. Now, you can use question 1 to free yourself from blindness and question 2 to fathom the unfathomable. However, none of this will keep you from persisting in your old investing errors if you can't control your brain. Investing is inherently counterintuitive. You can remind yourself of that all you like, but your cranial command center rebels. In a fight between you and your brain, your unruly brain will win. Unless you learn how to ask question 3. Next chapter. Chapter 3. Question 3. What the heck is my brain doing to blindside me now? It's not your fault. Blame evolution. One of the first things we learn about finance is buy low, sell high. In the movie Trading Places, when Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd prepare to corner the orange juice market, illegally and implausibly, but comically, you can tell the script writer was casting about for something finance-sounding to say. So Dan tells Eddie, buy low, sell high. What more advice do you need, really? We all know the goal, but more often than not, we end up doing the opposite. How hard can this be? Buy when stuff is priced low. Sell when it's priced high. It's not rocket science. And yet, this problem is ageless and endless. investors routinely buy and sell precisely backward. For evidence, consider the amount of money going into and out of equity mutual funds each month in the period just before and after the 2000 tech peak. Inflows for stock mutual funds were highest during February 2000, a good time to get out of stocks, at the peak of an ensuing three-year bear market. Fast forward to 2002, and the reverse is true. Huge numbers of folks bailed from funds in July, a fantastic time for stocks, just before a new bull market. Here is evidence of investors buying high and selling low en masse. These weren't a few deranged outliers. This shows widespread groupthink, frenzied mob lumbering in and out of the market, precisely backward. No one intends to buy high and sell low. That would be stupid. So why do so many of us end up doing the stupid? There are many convenient scapegoats. Following the 2000 to 2002 bear, folks claimed crooked CEOs and accounting fraud like Enron, MCI, and the rest. After the 2007 to 2009 bear market, it was greedy bankers, too much debt, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, or it's rotten politicians, or some social cause you hate, or. There's always a convenient scapegoat. Stop pointing your finger at everyone else. If you want to know what causes your investments to fare worse than you'd like, look in the mirror. Better yet, get a CT scan done. Your biggest investing enemy is your brain. Even more precisely, your biggest enemy is the cerebral evolution that formed your brain to be largely focused on keeping you alive in the face of starvation, treachery, and woolly, fanged beasts. To survive as a species, our brains evolved with specific goals in mind. Primarily, bodily survival in a primitive world. The easy ability to buy good food at the local supermarket or bistro and live relatively free from fear of instant death or dismemberment at the claws of predatory beasts is relatively new to human development, an advancement still in its infancy. Humans spent most of their evolution as hunter-gatherers, traveling in nomadic bands, hunting wild animals, foraging for often spoiled foods, finding mates to perpetuate the species, which is a lot more enticing than investing in stocks, avoiding predators, and seeking shelter. These are the tasks our brains evolved for, to keep us fed, warm, dry, and safe from wild beasts. Think of our Stone Age ancestors and how their survival struggle impacts how we behave now. Our ancestors' friends were their tribesmen and women, people they could trust. Their enemies were other tribes, rampaging beasts, and the dark things they couldn't understand. So they banded together for protection and lit fires to keep the dark and the dark things away. Recall our example of the noise outside the campfire. The same cognitive processes kept our ancestors alive and served them well for tens of thousands of years. It's only been a short time since they've caused us to make errors, and then only in limited realms, largely offset by other, more common life realms, where they don't hurt us to this day. Even with technology and the complexity of modern society, most of this preordained wiring remains intact. Pre-wiring, as a concept, is somewhat controversial among psychologists. Evolutionary psychology is sometimes equated with pop culture thinking by critics. I'll not attempt to retread the literature on evolutionary psychology here. For an introduction to this area, try How the Mind Works by Steven Pinker of Harvard, Norton, 1997. It covers a lot of turf fast. But I'm firmly convinced most of our shortcomings in seeing markets correctly stem from cranial hardwiring derived from many eons of evolution and are so fixed in our brains we can't escape them. Because we can't find people from 25,000 years ago to scrutinize now, we can never prove or disprove much of this. But based on studying what has and hasn't been proved and what is reasonable to me, I believe if you simply restrict your thinking about psychology to how we think about markets, you will see evolutionary psychology and hardwiring are very basic. Our brains are so structured that when information comes in a form our brains are hardwired to receive well, we process it correctly, easily, and quickly. When information comes to our brains in a form or framework our brain isn't hardwired to process well, we are often simply blind to it, and that's because our brains are hardwired by evolution to take certain types of inputs down defined paths and not elsewhere. You have already heard some of that with the PE and EP trade-off, but you'll hear it throughout this book, recurring in phenomenon after phenomenon. While behavioral finance is not based on evolutionary psychology, many discoveries paralleling evolutionary psychology have been uncovered in the past 35 years in behavioral finance. Behavioral finance. Behavioral finance is still a relatively new field of study, intersecting the fields of finance and human behavioral psychology. Advocates strive to expand our existing knowledge of how markets work, but, more important, how our minds work in relation to risk and markets. Until recently, the study of finance focused primarily on tools of investing, including statistics, history, theory, and market mechanics. Does category X typically generate higher or lower returns than category Y? How should a portfolio theoretically be constructed? What is the right way to think of diversification? How do indexes like this compare to indexes like that? What is the best measure of volatility? For mean variance optimization schemes, should we use variance or covariance? All fine, but basically all issues of mechanics, history, statistics, and theory in one form or another. Scholarly finance textbooks written in the 1990s don't differ much from those written in the 1970s. They address new technology, regulations, and products, sure, but they're mainly about the tools of investing. Traditional finance notions derive from traditional notions of economics, that humans in aggregate act rationally. Markets are efficient or at least semi-efficient, and individuals acting irrationally can be ignored. The nut job in the straitjacket has been identified and locked away and doesn't impact markets, in the traditional view. By contrast, behavioral finance assumes quirky behavior, or the person standard finance might view as a nut job, is pretty common. Irrationality is assumed to be potential behavior. Investors are presumed to behave in ways that sometimes seem irrational. Behavioralists try to discover the why. I think this is always easiest seen when you accept evolutionary notions that we're still influenced by our Stone Age ancestors. It's true. Our modern skulls contain Stone Age brains. Investors aren't rational automatons. They are humans and regularly behave in crazy ways when making financial decisions. And that is because our brains weren't set up to do this stuff. Our brains were set up to do survival stuff from a long time ago. If we can understand why people behave as they do, we can better understand how markets work and bet better based on what we know about human behavior. If you can understand your brain better, you can understand how to better control yourself so you can begin avoiding many of the typical mistakes investors make and begin lowering your error rate. For this, you need question 3. Before you take any market action, stop and ask, what the heck is my brain doing to mess me up, to make me blind now, to make me see and feel the situation exactly wrong and backward? After all, the market is nothing more than millions of people behaving like, well, cavemen. If you can unravel this code and understand your own decision-making process better, you can conquer your caveman brain and get humiliated less by TGH. That is the goal. It's not your fault your brain suffers cavemanisms. Our minds are conditioned to biases, making us do dumb things that seem really smart at the time. Questions 1 and 2 are intended to give you a framework for finding gameable bets. But those two questions are nothing if your brain runs ruinous. Hence, you need question 3. At one level, you're very, very smart. Your brain is an amazing pattern recognizer if information is fed to it even partly correctly. If information is fed to it incorrectly, you can't see a pattern at all. Most readers will have received some version of this goofy email. If you can read this, you have a strange mind too. Can you read this? I couldn't believe that I could actually understand what I was reading. The phenomenal power of the human mind. It doesn't matter in what order the letters in a word are. The only important thing is that the first and last letter be in the right place. The rest can be a total mess and you can still read it without a problem. Amazing, huh? Yeah, and I always thought spelling was important. And most readers can probably read it. It's a perfect EAXPMLE example of your brain being able to receive information well if delivered well. In this case, you don't even need it to be all that well delivered to be able to get it pretty easily. But often, if correct information is delivered exactly wrong, you can't see it at all. Our earlier PE examples are perfect in this regard. Maybe you've struggled with PEs forever without them making much sense to you, but by turning the PE into an EP, like an interest rate, your after-tax return on owning the whole business, it makes sense. The PE of 8 is a 12.5% return, which beats the heck out of a 6% pre-tax bond. Your brain gets that easily. The issue is knowing when your brain sees well and when it's actually hurting your ability to see reality. The Great Humiliator. It all goes back to TGH. TGH has endless ways to humiliate us. The bull market tops are typically marked by intense and comforting euphoria. Investors are never so enthusiastic about stocks as when pretty much every single person who might ever buy a stock has already done so, and there is basically no place left for stocks to go but down. Even worse, market tops usually roll and churn. They don't announce themselves with a sudden drop, like a correction. Everyone looks for some announcement like effect showing a bull market is over, but that almost never happens. There is an age-old but almost universally true statement nearly no one can accept. Bull markets die with a whimper, not with a bang. There isn't a dramatic spike top to bull markets if the historic measure is calculated correctly. Bear market bottoms are different only in form. TGH just confuses us differently. Bottoms are often violent and sharp, freaking everyone out so enough folks finally dump their stocks. Just when folks who first got into stocks at the peak abandon them from fatigue, stocks take off sharply, leaving the messes and the masses in the dust. It's just a bear market correction, pundits will say. I show in my 2011 book, Markets Never Forget, that the media routinely disbelieves a new bull market, sometimes for years. There is always a small universe of pundits that's bearish at the top, and probably consistently for the 3 previous years, and receives accolades for it, and then remains bearish at the bottom. No one notices that for years as people keep listening to them, fighting the last war. The potential for TGH to suck you in, chew you up, and spit you out is nearly infinite. Don't think TGH rests on its laurels in between peaks and troughs. During the normal course of a bull or bear market, the market can correct multiple times, that is, go briefly opposite to its longer-term trend by 10% to 20% or more. During the 1998 correction, mentioned in Chapter 2, the U.S. market spiked downward nearly 20% over only 6 weeks from July 17th to August 31st. That can terrify. And though corrections that size are fairly normal in bull markets, few remember or recognize one when next it happens. Corrections have investors dumping stocks just in time for the market to recover and move to higher prices, like in 1998. The market's year-to-date return was only at break-even late in the fall, yet by year-end, it was up 28.6%. The correction disappeared as fast as it came. TGH is fast. The market needn't move nearly enough to qualify as a true correction to have seemingly rational, intelligent human beings utterly terrified. Even professional investors, trained over time to turn a tough shoulder toward normal market volatility, will still regularly ask if a drop of a few percentage points over a few weeks augurs a bear market, recession, the apocalypse, or even Paris Hilton being nominated to the Federal Reserve Board of Governors. No, a drop of a few percentage points is what TGH calls Tuesday. Cracking the Stone Age Code. Pride and Regret. Admitting you have a problem is the first step to recovery. But you won't know you have a problem unless you ask question 3. What the heck is my brain doing to blindside me now? You can and will get multiple answers when you ask how your brain affects you. Some fall in the realm of your spouse, mother, or psychologist. The only ones concerning us here involve market behavior. Most interesting errors result from cognitive errors, the most common of which we cover here.
Look, me kill huge beast, me very skilled.
As mentioned in Chapter 1, behavioralists have shown normal Americans, we'll assume you're normal, hate losses about 2.5 times as much as they like gains. A 25% gain feels about as good as a 10% loss feels bad. Said otherwise, if you gain 10% over here and lose 10% over there, you feel like you're behind. Therefore, people typically exert more effort to avoid pain than achieve gain. This is commonly known as loss aversion, sometimes referred to as myopic loss aversion, intimating short-sightedness and an overactive reaction to short-term movements. It explains many investing errors. At root, myopic loss aversion and the mistakes it leads to are about 2 things: pride and regret. Our Stone Age information processors learned to do what is called accumulating pride and shunning regret. As matters of survival, imagine 2 hunters returning to camp at dusk. One carries a gazelle. The other has nothing but some broken spears that missed their marks. The hunter with the gazelle thrills the camp with his entrance. That night, he tells the tribe the story about how he skillfully and masterfully hunted and brought down the mighty beast. He talks about his deftness in forming the spear and how his spears are particularly deadly. He talks about the signs he interpreted, leading him to the grazing gazelles. He details his physical prowess in accurately launching his spear into the gazelle with deadly finality. He accumulates pride. It feels good and motivates him to eagerly go out to hunt again and again, so he can continue to experience that prideful high. And that is good for the tribe because it needs this young man to kill high-powered, animal-based protein that went a long way in those days towards separating those whose genes were passed on from those whose genes weren't. The other young hunter, the one with no gazelle, has a different story to tell. It wasn't his fault he didn't bag a gazelle. He has skill in spear-making and experience in tracking beasts, too. But on this particular day, a bolt of lightning scattered the gazelles moments before he could aim. Or maybe someone borrowed his spear so they weren't sharp enough. Or maybe there were lions roaming in his hunting ground. Or the wind was wrong. He fabricates seemingly plausible excuses so he can rise the next morning and try again. He shuns regret. In so doing, his campmates let him hunt the next day as well. Their belief in his story motivates him to try again. His tribe needs him to hunt too. Maybe he really was just unlucky that day. Even if he is a terrible hunter, he may stumble across an injured animal. Maybe tomorrow he will come across a gazelle just after it has been killed by a wild dog. Either way, it's worth it if protein accumulation is possible. Accumulating pride when successful and shunning regret when failing motivate both hunters to keep trying. Both of these tendencies are good for the tribe. Their tribe's very survival depends on their willingness to make repeated forays. The successful hunter hunts again and again. The unsuccessful hunter hunts again too. Many sources say investors are motivated by greed and fear. Behavioralists would disagree and suggest investors, and through them markets, aren't driven by greed and fear, but by humanity's drive to accumulate pride and shun regret. It just comes out as greed and fear. Pride is a mental process associating success with skill and repeatability. The hunter who bagged a gazelle believed he wasn't lucky. He believed himself masterful, more important. He believed he could repeat it. By writing this book, I too am displaying pride accumulated over a career span where I don't want to believe it was all just luck, that I was the guy flipping way too many heads for way too long. Who wants to believe that? The natural tendency of humans is to want to think success was because of skill and repeatability, not luck. Think about your own behavior after buying a stock that went up. Maybe it went up a lot. Did you pump your fist in the air? Did you congratulate yourself? Did you brag about it to your colleagues, spouse, and father-in-law? More important, did your success make you feel like you could do it again? I bought it. It went up. I'm smart. Want to see me do it again? Just like the hunter. Regret is a process of denying responsibility for failure, attributing it not to lack of skill, but usually to bad luck or victimization. The gazelle-less hunter isn't a bad hunter. He is just the hapless victim of poor circumstances. He'll kill a gazelle next time. I bought it. It went down. The broker sold it to me. He's the problem. Or, I bought it. It went down. The CEO was a crook. There are many ways to do bad luck and victimization. I wouldn't have bought it if my wife hadn't been ragging on me that morning. The mindset isn't, I bought it, it went down, I don't know how to do this, so I better not do it again, or I better work on this so I can get better. If the hunters didn't accumulate pride and shun regret, they would have become despondent over failure. They would have given up hunting giant beasts as a fool's errand. Their brains had to function this way to forage enough food to pass on their genes. It was a motivational tool. If a hunter became beset by regret and ultimately depressed, those benefiting from his future potentially lucky hunting would have starved and died. And that isn't such a good way to perpetuate the species.